So hi everybody, it's Gavin here and welcome to another edition of Storage Unpacked. This week we do not have an external guest, it's going to be the three of us talking about some of the myths that happen in the storage industry, which should be good fun. And this week I've got Chris with me. Hi Chris.
How are you doing, Gavin?
And Mr. Martin Glassford is back after not being available last week, so we're glad to have him back. Hi Martin.
Hi Gav, great to be back again.
Hey, always good fun. So we thought we'd actually spend a little bit of time talking about what goes on in the storage industry. There's already been a bit of funny back chat on this. I actually said, as a guy who's worked in marketing in the storage industry, I can't talk too much about some of these myths because it's like being thrown out of the magic circle for revealing their great secrets. But we're going to talk about some of the things that do go on, some of the practices used by vendors, and then just observations as we're all quite old of things we've seen over the years. So to kick us off, Martin, what do you think is one of the big things that you really see from going on in the storage industry?
Okay, over a number of years, I've seen people trying to define their arrays as enterprise, and often the feature which comes up is synchronous replication. It's interesting that few people seem to understand what synchronous replication really gives you and whether it's really necessary for anybody at all. So everybody says, oh, I need synchronous replication, I need it for DR. And then people seem to think there's something magic about it that allows you some instantaneous active data center capability, whereas it doesn't. This is nowhere near that. It gives you a crash-consistent file system. So if your data center burns down or your storage array blows up, you've got all your data, but it's in a crash-consistent form, so it's exactly the same as switching off a server. I see it often with DBAs. DBAs seem to think this will give them some ability to recover their database immediately. And you say, hang on, you're going to have to restart your database, and then potentially you might have corruption, it's going to have to redo all its redo logs, and they look horrified. So, but that's not what we were sold. And I think that's one of the big myths about synchronous replication. Mr. Evans, you must have seen this.
So first of all, I loved synchronous replication. It was just, oh, what a tool. Set it up, replicate your data, and you know it's all there. Now, from a storage perspective, as a storage person, great. Because then I don't have to worry about sitting there with people going and them saying, oh, I don't know whether it's all there, or, you know, that snapshot didn't complete properly, or this, that, and the other. From a user perspective, from a storage admin perspective, I should say, it was brilliant. Absolutely wonderful. But you're right. As soon as you then move up the stack, that's when things start getting tricky. And I think I see two bits to this. I think, first of all, when we had old one server per LUN, one per server per volume, and we had physical servers, yeah, it was a pain and you had to go through that process. But I think the world got even more complex when we moved to virtualization, and that made it even less valuable to be doing synchronous replication on data.
The whole point here, though, surely, is you're looking at synchronous replication as to what the techie guys think of it. Having sold SyncRep, and by the way, I love it because it made me a lot of money. But one of the reasons a lot of people bought SyncRep is to keep shareholders happy and to keep process people happy. To say that, you know, what is the impact of one of your buildings burning down, as you said, Martin? What is the impact of a bomb landed on your office in London? Will you be protected somewhere else? A lot of people bought SyncRep really to keep people at bay and just as a tick box, a very expensive tick box, but a lot of people it was just a tick box.
Yeah, it's an interesting one though, but for most people, with the exception of large financial services houses, they didn't really need synchronous replication. Asynchronous replication probably would have done exactly what they wanted. But they're not worried about the odd transaction going missing. Obviously, if you're a finance house and you've got millions of dollars being transferred around the place, you're kind of interested. You don't want to lose those transactions. But for most people, and I'd say most enterprises, they can actually afford a small amount of data loss.
I'd add two little bits to that, Martin. First of all, I'd say that even in the larger enterprises, and I think they probably worked this out over time, they didn't need to apply synchronous to everything because there are only certain applications where you need to be absolutely 100% guaranteed you kept that data. You know, you could easily go back and look at tons of applications that generated data from other applications like reports and so on, and you could rerun those. So you could, especially if it was something that was created every 24 hours, so there's no point replicating that because you'd be paying for a license for something you could just rebuild if you needed to. And I think the other side of it is that we definitely used it in the places I worked when we didn't really understand the complexity of the application. So we put all of the applications replications into one consistency group and replicated and failed over the whole lot. And that meant if we did it, it was everything or nothing. Now, I suspect the world's a million more times more complicated than that nowadays, and unpicking something or deciding how to fail over an entire application or application group isn't necessarily the right process.
Oh, exactly. So if you think about where it was in the past, where you had one server per LUN, even then, and you'd have not a huge number of servers per array. Now, potentially, you're talking about thousands of virtual servers or even hundreds of actual physical servers which can be talking to an array. You don't really want to fail over just because you've got one problem on one, say on one server or a couple of servers. You don't want to fail the whole lot over. So the synchronous replication thing just becomes very complicated very quickly. And then trying to work out which way you're supposed to be replicating and where your workload is with synchronous replication becomes pretty complicated. And I do know some very funny stories about synchronous replication where people have believed or don't quite understand what synchronous replication is. So where you say, you know, somebody's gone and done an rm-r in a file system.
Yep.
And they think they've got a copy. But no, the point of synchronous replication is you've just deleted everything on both sides.
I've seen customer engineers do that working for storage vendors and actually do the flow the wrong way as well. So set up a sync mirror pair to establish it and actually copy the blank volume over the full volume. It happens. It's dangerous.
I work with somebody who wrote an entire replication process built around a website so they could fail over their EMC arrays. And he didn't realize that you could apply the same commands to the R2. And I sort of explained to him, well, what happens when the R1 isn't there, when you've actually lost that box? And he was like horrified because he thought his whole process was broken until I said to him, you can run it against the R2. And he was like, really?
You brought up a good point about active-active as well, though, Martin, is that, you know, there's a lot of, even with sync rep, there's, you know, different degrees of it as well. And there's a lot of people avoid, especially some of the new wave flash vendors, there's a lot of people avoid getting into that active-active conversation because it isn't necessarily what it's marketed to be, and you need to analyse it.
And there's some interesting things with flash, all flash as well, with synchronous replication. If you've got synchronous replication over any distance, you can probably cripple your all flash array.
Oh, completely, yeah.
You're just not going to get the response times. Your latency is now 60 or 100 kilometres worth of fibre.
Yep, speed of light is a problem.
So synchronous replication, I was going to say, think seriously before you look at it because you probably don't need it.
Yep, I'll go along with that. But it's, as I said, just bear in mind, sometimes it's the business that demands it, not necessarily the technology. So the next one that seems to come up a lot is around snapshots, which has always been a sensitive subject because, again, snaps, clones, whichever way you want to look at it, there's always different versions of it. What's your feelings on snapshots, guys, and the way that people use them? Is it really necessary?
Snapshots are really useful. I love snapshots. They allow us to do point-in-time recoveries or very quick point-in-time recoveries. If somebody's done something stupid, VRM-R1's classic one, but they don't replace a backup. You still need to get your persistent data off your primary array somehow. Agree, disagree, Chris?
Entirely agree, Martin. I think snapshots can be incredibly useful, especially if you go for space-efficient snapshots, because obviously you're only ever then storing the differences between each time you take a snapshot. So I think used effectively, they can be very, very powerful. But as you say, people tend to forget the fact that that data is still stored on the same array, and if that array goes up, then all the snapshots and the data goes up.
I think that's the point where it needs to be looked at as a complete data protection strategy across using replication, using snapshots, using clones, whatever tools you've got to say, you know, what scenarios can happen. And then is you apply something that I call the paranoia scale. You can go all the way from, you know, not protecting your data right through to sync rep and load of snaps. And there is a relationship directly between your paranoia level and your total overall cost. And that's where I think, you know, a lot of CTOs have had to sit down and say, how far do we want to take this? Because we can end up spending stupid amounts of money to protect ourselves. But are we that paranoid?
I'd normally find those people with the least valuable data are the ones who shout most about losing it. They get very upset very quickly, and they're generally desktop users.
I won't name them, but I had a customer years ago that deemed email as non-critical, and then they had a problem. They had a system crash, and they had some mailboxes that were corrupt, one of which was the CEO's. Guess what? Email become critical.
Well, I've had this discussion before with when doing DR planning. This takes us a bit on a tangent, but almost the first service I believe you should bring up if you're hosting your own email is your email, on the grounds that how on earth are you going to coordinate all these hundreds of people without your email system? It's one of the most important services. It's almost category zero for a lot of people.
Yeah,
it's all Slack now.
And it's how the IT department communicate as well.
We do it all through Slack now. Email's history, it's all Slack.
Slack is bollocks. There you go. I said it.
On that note, I think we'll move on. So one I know that comes up a lot, and it's really funny, is someone that has to write, let's just put it as analyst responses to availability and stuff like that, is the great five nines myth. You know, how many nines is your product? Is it three nines, four nines, five nines? I've even seen people quote, you know, like 10 nines. Is this something, Martin, from an end user point of view, how seriously do you take the five nines argument?
How seriously do I take it? Not very seriously, because I've had conversations with vendors under NDA about what it really means. And as far as I know, and you've worked for vendors, it is generally considered as an aggregate over the population of an array. So actually, over the lifetime of a shipping product, that five nines can change somewhat as well. I mean, because you just look at historical figures. I've also found vendors sometimes get very upset or very cagey around the difference between, yet it goes back to our enterprise discussion, between enterprise and the small business arrays. Sometimes the small business arrays, if you look at how they're done, are easily as available. And so the five nines, six nines, unless you're going to guarantee it for my particular array, from the one I have on my floor, I'm not that interested. If you're willing to sign up to a guarantee, availability guarantee on that, and that's the array being up. Data availability or lack of data loss, I mean, that's quite important to us. I don't want arrays which lose data. Arrays which lose data are much more dangerous to me than arrays which go down. So I've seen that, and sometimes I take those figures a bit more seriously. I'm a bit more interested in those. I don't believe somebody when they come at six nines or seven nines.
See, that it's an interesting you said about guarantees. I worked for, let's just call them Vendor X, a number of years ago, who are offering five nines and had, more importantly, a lot of evidence of customers that have never experienced a failure, which to me, it's not about what statistic we can get. It's like mean time between failures on drives. Yeah. There's always going to be outliers, you know. And we just put them in touch with a lot of customers who had a lot of boxes and said, yep, we never had a problem. And then Vendor Y come along to them and said, we'll do 100% uptime guarantee. If your box falls over for even 30 seconds, we'll give you a load of cash. The company that were purchasing were in television production. And I said, what's more important to you, that your television programs go out with interruption and on time, or that you get a piece of cash as compensation? And they were like, yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah, all right, guarantees don't mean anything. You've got to go out there and look at the stats, and that has to be done over history. You know, go and find a customer that's had a box for 4 or 5 years, and say, right, how many service calls have you had? When you did have a service call, what happened when I hit that big red button and something went horribly wrong? Was my data safe? Was I protected? And more importantly, did they wrap me in cotton wool? To me, that's more important than a stat on a piece of paper, or even a flimsy piece of paper with a guarantee on it.
Martin's just made a really interesting point, though, about the way that we look at the statistics of these things. The fact that the five nines, six nines, seven nines doesn't necessarily translate to your box. It's an industry calculation across many, many customers. And obviously, a vendor can quote that number more comfortably or whatever, the more customers they have that level of availability. So for you to think that your box is guaranteed to be like that is like thinking that you're never going to have a car that's going to break down. You know, you could get one of those Friday afternoon cars where somebody obviously clocked off early or wasn't paying attention or had been down the pub the night before, and you have lots of problems with it. That could quite happily happen. So I guess it's understanding what that statistic means.
Yeah, I think that's important. And I've known people get very upset about an individual array falling over and shouting at vendors saying, but you said this was a 6.9's available box. It's fallen over. It's been down for half a day or a day. And people got very, very upset about it until you have to try and sit down, even as a user, as an informed user, to that particular person and say, you do realise these figures are calculated like this, and if you were to go across the whole user estate, not just ours, it's true. It's not our individual array which is guaranteed. It's or even statistically likely, we're the unlucky ones.
Yep.
We've been unlucky.
And let's face it, how would they calculate it any other way? How would they know that a box is guaranteed to be up or not go down for more than 30 seconds a year or something? It's how would they know unless they're taking averages across many, many products?
Yeah, exactly. So on that note, another thing that actually ties in with it is you often see people say that there are five nines array. However, you know, if you want to do a firmware upgrade, it can be done non-disruptively. Please note, and there's usually a little asterisk that says, you know, you'll be running on one controller, you'll be running in a degraded mode or something like that, and they don't apply those figures. Non-disruptive upgrade seems to be a little bit of a killer, especially in dual-headed arrays. Thoughts on that?
Yep, I can't disagree. I've seen it with not just with dual-headed arrays as well. Doing a firmware upgrade of any device, you're probably going to see a performance degradation. You don't want to do it at peak times. And that's if you talk to any vendor or any storage vendor, said, well, when you say it's non-disruptive, don't do it in your busiest peak time. If it was truly non-disruptive, they really shouldn't care. So you will see a performance. And your old employer, Gavin, if you look at going on a Symmetrics, if you went between families or out-of-family upgrades, yeah, they weren't non-disruptive.
Yeah, big impact.
And that's an enterprise class array.
Yeah. And they didn't, you know, and they claimed five nines on those arrays. So it was like, oh, no, it might have an impact, but it didn't take the system down. And that comes back to the other point is the five nines is made up of what? Is it, you know, the amount of arrays that have experienced complete and utter downtime? Well, as you said, you know, things like corruption may be more important, or at least degraded performance may be more important to some people.
Yeah, and the problem with a lot of these arrays, because they're not generally non-disruptive, because you potentially will see paths going up and down, that means as whole community or a whole data center, you may see systems fail because for whatever reason the multipathing's not right. They've been single pathed anyway. There's an issue on the SAN somewhere else along the line. So a non-disruptive, which is, I know it's a storage still available, actually can have quite dramatic impacts on your service.
Yep.
Because you might just see the outliers fall over.
And why would you want to do your upgrade at a time when you're in the middle of production day anyway, or you're in the middle of the most busy period? Because surely anything that changes that array, that puts it under stress at the time when it's the busiest, is more likely to cause it to go wrong in some way.
You'll be amazed how many customers I've seen do that, or at least attempt to do that, and go, oh, but the sales guy told us that it would be okay and it does non-disruptive upgrades. Really? Okay.
Or you get support teams telling you to do it because it will fix another problem you have. So you may...
That's true. I've seen that happen a few times.
And
yeah,
you may be...
Right.
The problem may actually may just be due to peak load, or they may say, well, do this and your performance will suddenly improve. Obviously, at the end point, you're potentially running into an upgrade at a run, which is never a good idea when you're talking about a lot of storage arrays.
It's, you know, would you change the wheels on your F1 car while you're doing 100 miles an hour?
No.
So one of the things that came up at a recent tech field day, we were meeting with Extreme.io and they talked about their upgrade process, and their upgrade process is continuously forward. So if they upgrade the code and it breaks something, they won't back it out. There is no back out. They only fix forward. So they have to go in, produce a fix, come back and reapply another version of code. Now, how does that fit into the non-disruptive scenario where at least if something went wrong and you could back it out, you might be down for a short length of time, but at least you can carry on running? Imagine being in a position where you upgrade and you break it, and then you have to wait for somebody to actually repair the code.
Chris, have you ever had discussions with the other big vendors about their backout plans for upgrades? I remember seeing a backout plan for a Symmetrics way back in the day, and it was you wouldn't do it. You would actually you would probably firefight it through because it involved swapping front end processors. God knows what. There was no real plan of how to get out of it.
I've been in the position where we've had that discussion, probably more with Hitachi technology than, say, EMC, although we've been through that process as well. And I'm fairly certain from memory we typically did have a backout plan of some sort. You wouldn't necessarily, as you say, want to go there, depending on what that upgrade and backout was. Certainly, if there were any hardware upgrades and replacements in there, potentially, no, absolutely not. You wouldn't want to back those out because that would be very hard to do. But if it was just a plain code upgrade, I'm sure we did have some of those were definitely backout capable.
I think you're probably right, and it probably depends how dramatic the upgrade is. Where you do get upgrades which change the layout on disk, so I have come across the odd ones like that, which will change how the disk's layout works, so it's moving data around. It is very hard to get out of it.
Yeah, but then, and that's a good point, I agree with you, that can be something you potentially decide you're going to commit to, but then with those, of course, you look at it and say, well, I'll do something else, or I'll have another plan to back out of that. I might get us back to the synchronous replication thing. I might have a second array, and I might suspend
swing kit scenario.
Replication, yeah. some other process that allows me, if that box dies on the upgrade, I've got to get out of jail free. And I think that's a standard process that anybody who's been in storage a long time is, there is never going to be one route and then I get stuck. I always will try and find something else to get me out of the brown stuff if I get really stuck.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and I think that comes down to experience with what people have been through and the storage admin. But if we're looking over the next few years with the death of a storage admin, some of these hard-learned lessons may be forgotten.
So some of what we've been talking about are, a lot of the times, are misunderstandings. People not being aware of how the technology works and how they use things. We've started to lead on to some of vendors' claims, and you know, I've certainly seen it. I'm not necessarily saying vendors I've worked for, but I've certainly seen false claims out there in the marketplace. And probably the number one thing I've certainly seen is around performance. And it's actually quite frustrating as someone who gets involved in the analyst reports. So as a vendor, we have to go and tell an analyst what our performance levels are, what we've seen in the field, is they actually often go out and make judgments based upon performance. So they'll say, they'll rate a vendor so many out of 10 for their performance levels, purely based upon what that vendor's told them, rather than actually somebody testing it, which is quite scary. And one of the things we know for a fact is pretty much, you know, any IOPS or bandwidth or latency claims that tend to be on data sheets often aren't the case. Is that something, you know, as a purchaser of storage, Martin, in the past, where you take some of the numbers and halve them? It's a bit like mileage claims for cars. You know, the amount of miles per gallon that the vendor claims, we know is not reality. It gives you a rough guide, but we know it's not reality, so we have to halve them. What's your thoughts on, you know, data sheet marketing numbers?
We generally halve them. This general rule of thumb, halve it, and we generally expect to see a little bit better than half, but we just feel very strongly that the claims which are made, certainly around performance, are based around having a decent tailwind. So, or if it's the perfect workload, and we know workloads aren't perfect, you'll run mixed workloads, you'll run all kinds of things on array. So, but it's certainly IOPS claims and latency. And in the past, we also know that IOPS claims have been particularly bad because they've never really put anything around the latency. So it's a million IOPS, but it's not really, because each individual IOPS is taking a long time to serve. So we take them with a big pinch of salt. I think that would be the fair statement to make on that one.
It's a bit like they always say. I always say a Skoda can do 100 miles an hour if you throw it off a cliff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Chris, thoughts?
Yeah, I think if you look back at the way that the numbers are quoted, and then you look back at your environment and look at the way you configure it, then historically, say 10 or 15 years ago, you could configure something incredibly badly, especially on spinning disk media, and find that you wouldn't get any throughput at all. And as Martin says, you know, a lot of that bandwidth wasn't just what you'd get out of a single LUN, it was what you'd get out of the whole array. So you really needed to be thinking about things like how you loaded front-end directors, the back-end directors. If you weren't stressing the entire equipment, you were never going to get anywhere near the IOPS that they were suggesting. So a badly laid out environment could really have a problem for you in terms of the array. Now, going forward, obviously, our flash vendors are saying that that's less of an issue and that we've got many more IOPS to use than we did before, but I still think there must be the possibility that you could end up misaligning or not load balancing effectively enough to make the most out of a system. So I think I just would, as Martin says, see it the same way. Just see it as a really high number and then work down from there. But it highlights one thing I think that we have as a problem in the industry, and that is it's still almost impossible to estimate what your workload requirements are and match that to the exact amount of hardware you need to buy.
Yeah, it's an absolute killer. Looking at an application and trying to work out what the real IOP requirement is, to do that kind of calculation, application developers can't do it. They don't quite understand the back-end infrastructure. We can't do it because we don't necessarily understand the application. You get all kinds of things going on with badly written code. So that can hide all kinds of problems. Badly written database queries. All these things can thrash an array, and you don't necessarily see the performance you expect. And the other thing is, the IOPS claims, as generally as an end user, we have no way of proving either way. It's very hard to prove either way what have we done badly or what have we done well, and how do we actually show that we've got what we've bought?
Yeah, that is really a tricky one that never seems to ever get resolved. And I must admit, in lots of places that I've been, We've tried to get the vendors to commit to some sort of performance guarantee, but it's very difficult to work out how you write that and how you measure that and how you quote that in a contractual way that allows you to go back and prove it one way or another.
Yeah, you can take a workload model. You can take an existing historical workload and you can model it or you can record it. And it's fine for that day. So you put it on and your storage vendor says, yep, it's going to work with that. But workloads don't stay the same. And so 6 months later, you're looking at an array which is on its knees. And then you go back and have to remodel it. So things change. So another reason for halving it is you generally means that you've got some kind of headroom for change.
And I wonder whether we should care in some respects about that. About whether we want to get really accurate, because if we can't do it and the application developers can't do it, and they probably can't even size VMs or servers accurately anyway, and they certainly never could in my experience, then I don't see why they should expect the storage guys to be more accurate about the way that the storage should perform.
I think the problem is storage is often bought in, because storage is big purchases, Chris, and it's bought in advance, it's very easy to get things wrong and make expensive mistakes.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it does tend to get... does tend to increase to be more and more of the cost of the equipment in the data center. So yeah, that's a fair point.
So the one thing that I've always wondered, and you know, I've never worked for a vendor that's done this, so please make sure that you're not going to accuse me of anything. But I've been in a lot of situations where benchmarks where the boxes act what I would call unnaturally. We've certainly seen things where vendors insist on a 24-hour benchmark period. Usually with hybrids, because we know what they're trying to do is not ever fill up the flash and let it get to the disk. But, we've seen in the VW situation with Volkswagen of, situations where figures have been tweaked and tainted with to get the results they want of. Do you guys reckon that goes on in benchmarks? Have you ever seen it happen? Do you think there's almost a VW style scandal waiting to happen in the storage industry?
I'm not sure about the storage industry. We do know it's happened in the wider IT industry. So we certainly do. If you've ever looked at graphics cards, it's happened in the past. There was
really?
A big scandal in the consumer market around that, where one of the graphics card vendors was detecting some of the benchmarks and behaving differently. So we technically it's possible. I don't know of any storage vendor who's done it. I don't know of any server vendor that's done it. Would it surprise me? I don't know.
So what would the implication be, that the vendor has somehow detected that as a benchmark running or something and therefore somehow manages to make their box run faster than it would do if there wasn't the benchmark running?
Yeah, either faster or turn certain features off and acting in unnatural ways.
Turn off error checking or something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you could turn some of the dedupe off and do it much more post-process or something like that to get the, Wow, that'd be a really underhand thing to do, wouldn't it? I mean, but you're right though. Some of the results I've seen from some benchmark testing does make you wonder whether the vendors in somewhere are gaming it just simply by structuring the test in a certain way. I'm not sure whether they would actually have code that's allowing them to do that as well, but I've certainly seen them sort of structure it to their advantage.
Just something to think about anyway. One that we do know has actually changed a lot of behavior, and I've certainly seen this get better over the last couple of years, is the good old effective capacity. And I'm making the quotation marks on my fingers as I say that.
Air quotes.
Air quotes, that's the one. So as, when we started to see the rise of the all-flash array madness, as I call it, where everybody and his dog was selling all-flash arrays, I was seeing stupid numbers like 10 to 1, 11 to 1. People complain, saying that you can have an OLTP database and you'll still get 10 to 1 ratios. Seems to have got a lot better lately, but do people really take that seriously? When we look at effective capacity and price per gig, are people still, do you think, being hoodwinked?
I think some people are. I think generally the big enterprises know enough about it. We know what our workloads look like. We know how they compress and how they dedupe now. So we have some pretty good ideas about what happens. So any storage vendor who turns up with some stupid figures, eyebrows will be raised and we'll say, okay, we'll prove that. Ben, are you willing to sign up to that?
Christ, you must get it with video files, Martin.
Oh, well, don't worry. I've had some really interesting conversations with people saying, oh, yeah, we can press this. And I say, I don't think you can. And they look at, oh, yeah, no, we're sure. I actually turned down one big vendor. One big vendor wanted to write in some guaranteed compression ratios. I said, no, I will not allow you to do that because that's an unfair contract. And they were like, they looked at me, what do you mean? I said, because I'm going to be putting video files on that and they're already compressed. And yeah, so I've actually had to call some big vendors and say, don't be stupid, you can't do it.
I think we saw a maturing of the way people looked at it. So initially when we saw those figures coming out, they came out, as you said, with very big numbers. And I think a lot of vendors either then had trouble when they went into clients and clients put stuff on and they got burned or it all got a bit messy. But I think it sort of matured and they started splitting out things like what was saving through dedupe, what was a saving through compression. So you could start to at least understand what your environment might be in a bit more detail. I guess that was done when, certainly with flash environments, when the cost of the array was really important and dedupe and compression ratios actually were saving the cost and making it look more acceptable. I think now that there's a more competitive, just general flash market, and we're not comparing to hybrid all the time, I think that sort of saving and TCO calculation isn't as valuable to the salespeople anymore.
And I think there's some cloud vendors out there who are using it as their margin. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're deduping within, but yeah. And it's a good way of making a lot of money.
Absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, why give the dedupe to the end user when you can save it for yourself?
You're selling sell the same capacity 10 times.
Yeah, good point. So that's good, guys. We've already been through 6 myths of the storage industry. I think we could probably come up with not just 6 more, but probably 60 more if we carry on here all day. So it's probably a good time to cut things short. I think we'll definitely come back with a myth of the storage industry too, but it would be good to hear from some of our listeners on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on email, or if you see any of us in the pub throwing things at us. Let us know some of the things that you see out there and you'd like us to discuss, because it's always good to hear back from people. So the only thing to do now is to thank Martin and Chris for their time today. Thanks, guys. It's been good.
Yeah, thanks, Gavin.
Yeah, cheers, Kevin.
And as usual, everybody knows how to contact us, but please do keep up with Twitter, subscribe to us, let us know what you think and what we can talk about. But we'll catch you on the next recording of Storage Unpacked. Thank you, everyone.